Curious City is supported by the Poetry Foundation, with a reminder that Chicago is the pulse of poetry. Visit the Poetry Foundation on the corner of Superior and Dearborn to explore their library of 40,000 books, attend public events, and view Frente a la Vida, Facing Life, a striking multidisciplinary art exhibition by Chicago artist Victoria Martinez. Learn more at poetryfoundation.org. WBEZ's nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
What's up, Chicago? I'm Erin Allen, and this is Curious City. As you heard in our last episode, immigrants have been targeted many times in Chicago's history. Today, we're going to look back at the story of one particular Chicago immigrant who was targeted for his Japanese heritage during World War II. A big part of his story involves personal resourcefulness, audacity, and a community in Chicago that was really supportive. He relied on his wits, asked for help, and got it. I'm talking about Jun Fujita.
He was an adventurous guy. He was out there doing stuff. He's the fanciest looking photographer I've ever seen.
And the person here to talk about him is his great nephew and biographer, Graham Lee.
His life seems to be divided into photography, poetry, naturalistic stuff. Mm. And then when he was in the city, he was, oh gosh, he was dressed to the nines. You know, he just had a silk cape, a red lined cape going to the to the symphony. You know, it's like, this is a guy who is just like, I'm not hiding. Yeah. I am just going out there and I'm being me.
Now, if you don't know the name Jun Fujita, you probably know of his work, which is a great introduction to who he is. He's the photographer behind some of the most memorable and graphic images taken in Chicago in the 20th century, going back as early as 1914. Like his photograph of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, which showed the murder of several gang members in Lincoln Park on February 14th, 1929.
Bodies on the floor. The machine guns have riddled through them, and it's become an iconic photo of gangland violence in Chicago.
Wow.
Yeah. June took it.
Or any of June's many photos of the Eastland disaster in 1915. That was when a passenger ship flipped over at the Clark Street Bridge and 844 people were killed.
The ship is tipping over in the Chicago River, spilling out bodies into the river. And the story goes that one of the editors at the Chicago Evening Post is trying to get a hold of him. June, June's got to get down there. He was already there. So how he got there, how he knew to be at the right place at the right time is one of those fascinating mysteries.
Or June's photos of the Chicago race riot of 1919.
He was on the scene chasing after white rioters, chasing after black men and women and children. And he was there when a young black man was stoned to death. And this picture and how the sequence was, you know, he must have been taking film in and out of his camera so fast to capture this
A sequence of the same event. Yeah, interesting.
But he captures, you know, a white man holding a brick just about to land on this black man who's on the floor. And it's it tells a huge story.
June was one of the first Japanese-American photojournalists, and he was a published poet. But he was also targeted for his immigration status. After Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, the U.S. government classified June and many thousands of Japanese Americans as quote-unquote enemy aliens.
The time, spring and summer of 1942. The place, 10 different relocation centers in unsettled parts of California, Arizona, Utah, Idaho.
Now, it was mostly West Coasters who the government displaced and put into internment camps. But June also had to worry about his security here in Chicago.
We knew that some among them were potentially dangerous, but no one knew what would happen among this concentrated population if Japanese forces should try to invade our shores.
So how did June navigate all this at the time and not end up in an internment camp? I sat down with Graham to hear June's story. Graham Lee is the great nephew of June Fujita, and he's working on a biography about June. Graham, welcome to Curious City.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Tell me about June's early life before North America was even a part of the equation.
June grew up in Japan, went to school there, went to a missionary school, actually, which may have given him a first glimpse at the English language. A relative of his was running a newspaper, and he got an assignment from the newspaper to go shoot the salmon and lumber industries in Canada. So he left. He spent 3 years in Canada. It's not completely clear why he ended up in Chicago. You think maybe like one of the other coasts might have been attractive. But there's a there's an excerpt saying that Chicago was a place to test your mettle. And so I think that he looked at that as a challenge. And clearly it was the right move for him because he fell in love with Chicago.
Wow.
And never left.
Do you know much about how he adapted to the language, the culture?
Everything about June's story tells me that he was like the supremely confident person. I think even having maybe a shortage of dexterity of the language probably didn't hurt him that much. I don't think it hampered him. He didn't finish high school in Japan, so he decided to enroll in school here. He finished in 3 years. So he had a professor at school who's like, I think I've got an opportunity for you. Go to the Chicago Evening Post. So in 1914, he says he drifted in to the Chicago Evening Post and got a job as the camera, as the first Japanese photojournalist.
Okay. And do you know of his daily life? Like, where did he live in the city? Who was his community while he was here?
So he ended up in Hyde Park in an apartment there. And there were a bunch of other reporters that lived there. John Drury was a resident. Emil Armin, who was an artist from the Chicago Art Institute, lived there as well. He just jived with an artistic community. And you could tell that they were kind of a tight-knit community. Mm-hmm. I think they were probably always kind of looking out for each other, helping each other. I think you had to.
Mm-hmm. So was he doing quite a bit of writing during that time? I heard you say that he'd written about how he ended up at this
yep.
publication.
I think he had kind of the poetry in mind all the time, but there was it really came to fruition when someone at the newspaper showed him Tanka poetry, and rather boldly he said, "That is not Tanka poetry. I will show you Tanka poetry." And that set him off on like creating some pristine Tanka poetry.
Wow. What is Tanka poetry?
Similar to haiku.
Ah,
so
very short
very precise language. He would lie in the dining room table with individual poems and kind of walk through each one and kind of change one word at a time, which I thought was kind of fascinating. So kind of honing all of them.
Wow. I always admire people who kind of try their hand at anything that piques their interest.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It sounds like, you know, he's writing and he was doing visual art. Anything else that we've missed on the list so far?
Oddly enough, he loved kitchen gadgets. So he okay. he was a chef and a cook. Baked Alaska was one of his favorites. And I think the play on words also probably really got to him. Baked Alaska and this kind of, you know, it's ice cream in a hot dish. You know, like, I'm sure he loved it.
At some point, June started to be quite famous and well-known for his work as a photographer. Any names of famous people that really sought him out?
June was like a regional kind of celebrity, I think. And he did have this draw to him. You know, he was introduced to Hemingway, for example, through newspaper reporters. Faulkner was another one of those people who kind of was in that circle. Mm-hmm. But June would have dinner parties, probably had Baked Alaska there. often it's described to me that conversations would be happening and June would be rather quiet. And then people would turn to June and say, "What's your comment on the subject?" And he would make some kind of kabuki gesture and pronounce something, and then the conversations would go on.
Interesting. Graham says even the most notorious mobster in America sought out June's skills, but not necessarily for photography.
The story goes that a big black car was going down Michigan Avenue. June was walking down the sidewalk. The car stopped aside beside him. The window rolls down. It's getting very cinematic here, right?
Yes.
The head pokes out, and it's Al Capone, and says, "I hear you're good with knives. We could use you on our team. We'd call you Chopstick." And
ooh.
June declined. And I think the closing comment to Al Capone was, "I'm better with a camera than with knives."
Okay. Leave it to the artist to do some self-promotion, even in a perilous moment.
That's right. That's right.
The first time the federal government started tailing June was during World War I. Graham says somebody at the Chicago Evening Post thought June might be up to no good, so they called the Bureau of Investigation, which was the precursor to the FBI, and they started following him.
There's records of June being tailed, you know, with like subject leaving the building, heading west. Oh, looks like subject is just taking pictures of the women protesting outside. Nothing to see here. And there's several like that that go on really with nothing to show.
Do you know if the circumstances that would have caused, you know, the U.S. government to be like, let's tail this person?
It's paranoia, right? It's just got to be, we don't trust this guy. He's Japanese. We're suspect. You know, World War I is, there's mistrust.
Mm-hmm.
Mistrust.
Before the Second World War, Graham says June did what he could to be seen as an upstanding member of his adopted country. He applied to the Navy. He filled out his draft card.
America prepares. All America alters its pattern of life and work to meet the demand for protection.
But what started off as paranoia from the U.S. government eventually became a lot more serious for June.
December 7th, 1941. No American will ever forget this Sunday morning in Hawaii.
After Pearl Harbor, his assets were immediately frozen. At that time, he was running a commercial photography shop. It was shut down. His money was frozen. His cameras were taken away. It looked pretty perilous. For sure, they would have heard about internment camps. Things were kind of happening fast. I have a letter on December 8th from June, kind of pleading his case, like, I'm an American. My purpose here has always been just to be an American citizen. My goal is to be an American citizen. I don't consider myself an enemy alien, which is now what I'm classified as. And you can tell that real concern that June was having about what could happen to him,
mm-hmm.
really pleading his case. And I think what really saved him was knowing these people
mm-hmm.
that had suddenly risen from earlier years in his newspaper days, now in a powerful position in the government, were able to vouch for him.
Sure.
Harold Ickes, who was Secretary of the Interior, and Michael Strauss, former editor at the Chicago Evening Post, who was now bureau chief in D.C. and part of the Department of Interior.
My dear June, your note of December 8th, stating you find yourself an enemy alien and that your funds are frozen and that you are out of business, was distressing. I have no doubt that you will be dealt with justly by the government, but I also realize that you are not in an enviable position immediately, through no fault of your own.
Now, did June ask Strauss and Harold Ickes to speak out on, you know, in his favor, or were they just kind of stepping up?
Oh, June definitely reached out to them to try and promote loyalty to the United States. In fact, June offered services like, I'm not super great at reading Japanese anymore or speaking Japanese, but if you need me to during this time, I will help you.
Interesting.
It was also during this time that June married Florence. So they'd been living together as an item for, 20 years?
Yeah, let's talk about that. I know that this is your great aunt.
Yep.
Florence Carr and June ended up getting married around the same time that he was at risk of being sent to an internment camp.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so tell me about the circumstances around that.
The sense is that, what are we doing? We've been together for so long. Why aren't we married?
Mm-hmm.
And the thought that maybe being married might help protect June during the war years. So they went to a justice of the peace. They got married. And I'd like to think that it helped.
Graham says he thinks their marriage may have helped protect June because Florence was both American and white.
They did decide not to have children. They were very concerned about things that they had seen and witnessed about how interracial children might be perceived. So Florence even had a hysterectomy make sure that nothing would, they didn't want to risk it at all, which I think is super sad. But on the upside, they considered their niece and nephew, so my mother and her brother, like their own kids. And it's for them, because of them, that I have as many stories as I do because they were really close.
Yes, yes. Ultimately, how close did June come to being sent to an internment camp?
I would say that everyone was taking it seriously. So the newspaper armed June with a gun, for example.
Wow.
Had his suits tailored to have an under-the-arm pistol with him, carried a knife around with him. I don't know what that really was going to do if the government came after you, but it lends itself to the seriousness of the situation.
Sure.
They're trying to protect him and make him feel secure. He definitely constrained himself to Chicago, so he stopped going to his cabin, which was kind of his place out of the city up in northern Minnesota on a lake.
Hmm.
Once World War II started, he never returned.
Graham says all these factors, marrying Florence and the support of people like Michael Strauss, played a part in helping June stay put in Chicago. But his tenacity was also an advantage.
It feels to me like June was somehow kind of insulated, that something about his own character, you know, he was supremely confident in things.
Hmm.
And I think maybe his bearing might have given him an edge in, like,
sure,
I'm just walking down the street, got my shoulders back, I'm doing my job and I'm going forward.
Do you know if he ever gained citizenship here in America?
He did. In 1954, he was naturalized, so he was 65, I think, at the time. And it was his lifelong dream.
Yeah. When it comes to being watched, surveilled, being threatened with incarceration, things like that happened to June are happening right now to immigrants across the U.S.
Yeah, absolutely.
And in Chicago. As you're working on this biography and also living in this current climate, how are you thinking about those two kind of parallels?
It's heartbreaking to see us being torn apart. And I think for June, his story of kind of, I'm not sure overcoming is the right word, but surrounding himself with the right people, having a community that you trust and love, and moving forward with confidence and surety, no matter what's happening around you, to me, that's kind of what I take out of June's story, is like his legacy in some ways of, like, here's an immigrant story, the American dream, you know, success coming to another country. It worked for him.
Mm-hmm.
That it doesn't work for people now is heartbreaking, because we should all have equal opportunities to do things that we want to pursue.
Graham Lee is the great nephew of June Fujita, and he's working on a biography about June. Graham, thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure. I'm glad everyone here is so curious about June.
June Fujita, Behind the Camera, a biography by Graham Lee, is available for pre-sale from the Hat and Beard Press. We'll put a link in the show notes for this episode. This episode of Curious City was produced by me and Justin Bull. Mary Hall is our digital producer. Susie Ahn is our editor. Curious City is a production of WBEZ Chicago and is a part of the NPR network. If you have questions about Chicago and the region, send them our way at curiouscity.org or visit us at wbez.org/curiouscity. I'm Erin Allen. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you next week.
Rise and Shy, WBEZ is serving local stories for breakfast every weekday morning from 5 to 11. Tune in on the WBEZ app to hear what Chicago's talking about as you start your day.